Good afternoon. I'm Kent Siegel from Sherman and Howard, and I represent the appellants Bradley and Marty Buchanan and their entity, the Flying Bee Bar Ranch. As the panel knows, the case at bar involves the grant of a motion for summary judgment based upon the statute of limitations of the plaintiff's two claims for relief. Those claims involve a fraud claim, and they involve a claim involving allegations of violations of the Colorado Consumer Protection Act. The claims arise out of the allegations that the defendants, that is, Rodney Atherton and his law firm Snell and Wilmer, both fraudulently and deceptively promoted conservation easements to the plaintiffs, Mr. and Mrs. Buchanan. As the panel is well aware, because these are a fraud claim and a claim for violations of the CCPA, they involve not only misrepresentations or omissions of fact, but they also involve knowledge of those misrepresentations or omissions. That important consideration is going to have significance with respect to why, among other reasons, it was error to grant the motion for summary judgment. As the panel is well aware, because this is a grant of a motion for summary judgment, the standard for review is a de novo review. The chronology that's important is that the complaint was filed in February 2013, and the motion argued, and the trial court accepted the argument, that the plaintiffs either knew or should have known, and there was no distinction by the trial court, they either knew or should have known that their claims accrued in August of 2008. I'll address the significance of that August date in a minute in terms of my argument. Let me first, by way of background, suggest that we raised both issues of law and issues of fact in terms of the error in granting the motion for summary judgment. Significantly, in the reply brief, the defendants try to restate the issues on appeal. And I want to address those very briefly because I think it's a telling admission that rather than address the numerous and repeated factual errors, the fact that there was disputed evidence in the record, and the fact that the court misapplied the law, what they suggest is that the plaintiffs understood that the defendants' conservation easements were challenged in multiple legal arenas. Now, what's significant, and the court should understand this from reading our briefs, those challenges in multiple legal arenas involved different transactions, different parties, and most importantly, none of those challenges involved the misrepresentations that were the basis of the claims, nor did they in any way involve the contention that the plaintiffs had knowledge of those misrepresentations. So what the defendants have tried to do is take circumstantial evidence, which the trial court accepted, and infer or extrapolate that the plaintiff should have had knowledge of their claims. That's one of the issues they redefine. The second is they say the issue that is before the court is whether the plaintiffs discovered information to put a reasonable person on notice of their claims. The question of whether a reasonable person would have notice of a claim is inherently a factual issue. And there are multiple issues of fact involved in this case, but notwithstanding the long-held rule that whether or not a party should have known an issue involves an issue of fact, the trial court decided it as a matter of law. Let me come to one of the fundamental legal errors that's involved in the motion for summary judgment. And as I said before, this is a de novo review. At page 13 of the motion for summary judgment, and you can find it in the transcript electronic transcript 393. The defendants argue that whether or not the plaintiffs should have known their claim should be determined based upon the doctrine of inquiry notice. Now, in the reply brief on appeal, they suggest that they cited cases involving inquiry notice. And as I'm certain the court has become aware, when you read the cases they cite, absolutely none of them are statute of limitations cases. And they say, well, we cited it for different reasons. I beg to differ. If the panel will read page 13 of the motion for summary judgment, which you are focusing on, you will see that the defendants have argued, based upon the doctrine of inquiry notice, the plaintiffs were on notice of their claims. What's the importance of this? That takes us to the Salazar case. Salazar versus American Sterilizer Company. This court decided in the Salazar case, and it's at page 357. The citation is 5 Pacific 3rd, 357. A very specific, clear ruling that totally refutes the argument made by the plaintiffs. What they say is, we reject defendants' contention that inquiry notice triggers the discovery rule. The foundation of the should have known argument is based upon the incorrect and flawed argument by the defendants that inquiry notice triggers it. And they tried to sidestep it on appeal, but I submit to you, if you read page 13 of their motion and consider it as part of the de novo review, it is at the heart of their argument, and it is one of the numerous reasons why the judgment should be reversed.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Siegel, if I may, please.
Yes, sir.
I'm not so sure, and I've been over this trial court order several times, I'm not so sure that the trial court in its order landed on an inquiry notice analysis. Rather, the court cited Olson, a much more recent case, in its analysis. And if the trial court didn't rely on the issue of inquiry notice, do we really care about whether they're arguing it or not? Don't we look at what the court did?
Well, you care for two reasons. Number one, they applied the same methodology. You're right, they cited the Olson decision, and they articulated the issue of whether they should have known. But should have known is inherently a factual issue. And when you look at the fact that they reached that conclusion based upon issues, none of which directly pertain to it, and then you consider the Olson case does not involve either a fraud or CCPA case. Let me come back to that point, where an essential fact that cannot be concluded as a matter of undisputed fact is whether the Buchanans had knowledge of whether or not the defendants knowingly made misrepresentations. So, because it's a de novo review, you are looking at what's in the motion. You're correct. The trial court did not specifically articulate that it's based on inquiry notice. But that is the issue that is before the court because it's de novo. And moreover, the Olson analysis, and let me turn to the factual errors, because there are numerous factual errors. We recite in our motion the fact that the trial court misstated facts when they suggested one of the reasons Judge Frick said we conclude that the plaintiffs knew about this is because they were aware there was a lawsuit involving the very, very same kind of transaction. She was referring, if the court remembers, to the BDR2 transaction. One of the many factual flaws by Judge Frick, and the evidence is absolutely clear on that, is while she, on two occasions in her order, described the BDR2 transaction as very similar, the evidence shows that it was viewed as starkly different. You may remember, Judge Bernard, that Mr. Buchanan hired Michael Plackey, who worked at the law firm of Rothgerber and Johnson. When Mr. Plackey was assisting Mr. Buchanan before the Colorado Division of Real Estate, and the issue came up as to whether or not Mr. Buchanan was concerned about the BDR2 transaction that he did not invest in, Mr. Plackey said that is, quote, a starkly different transaction. Now, notwithstanding the evidence, Judge Frick based her opinion as to why the plaintiffs should have known by on two occasions describing the fact that he was aware, that is Buchanan, of a lawsuit involving a very similar transaction. One of the many illustrations of the factual errors. Let me go over some of the other factual errors. Ted Buchanan unconditionally testified, I had no knowledge of any of the events of fraud until the summer of 2011. The trial court totally disregarded that. And that is not, as the defendant suggests, self-serving evidence.
Well, pardon me. At least in 2010, when the IRS comes in with the tax deficiency notice, that's got to be a pretty good suggestion, doesn't it? And I understand.
It does.
I understand that that's after 2008, where the defendants say that the time ran. But nonetheless, before 2011, there's at least one real big bell rung, right?
Well, whether it's a bell rung in terms of knowing there was fraud is an important distinction. And perhaps you're talking about the Hoover case. The deficiency notice occurs in May of 2010. And so that's an important distinction, because we're dealing with 3-year statute of limitations. So if you take the deficiency notice as the event that triggers it, even accepting without regard to the fact that these are fraud cases,
you're still within 3 years if that's it. But I was just suggesting that there is at least one fact in the record that suggests before 2011 that he should have known that this was a problem.
There is a fact in evidence with respect to the deficiency, but it doesn't change the result. The summary judgment should be reversed, because if you take that, and that was part of our argument, is arguably in May of 2011, the claims accrued based upon the deficiency notice. That is the Hoover case, but it still gets you to a reversal. I've got limited time. I want to talk for a minute about Michael Plackey and the critical testimony that you find that Judge Frick disregarded. Once again, in the order, Judge Frick said she primarily relied on testimony by Plackey and Buchanan. But what Plackey said, because it's important with respect to the August of 2008 date, he warned Mr. Buchanan that Snell was representing, or rather that Rothgerber was representing Snell in a separate lawsuit. And it was that statement, along with, if you want to sue Snell, you need to get separate counsel, that Judge Frick relied on. Totally ignored by Judge Frick were three critical facts that Mr. Plackey also said that the defendants now say are immaterial. But let me stress those, because they also compel a reversal of this decision. Plackey said, I didn't think the Buchanans had a claim at that point. He also said that because there had been no deficiency, I didn't think there was a claim. And he said, I didn't think that Buchanan thought he had a claim. Let me also add one other point. All of these are in the record. He also suggested that there was no conflict in the simultaneous representation, giving further credence to the fact that he did not view there to be a claim. I would suggest to you, Judge Frick pick and choose the evidence, and the evidence of factual disputes is repeated throughout the evidence and well summarized in our briefs. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Palmieri, registration number 14252. Along with my co-counsel, Heather Kelly, we represent the law firm of Snell & Wilmer. Jim Kilroy, a representative of the firm, is also present. Tamara Westerberg and Anthony Barbie are co-defense counsel representing attorney Rodney Atherton. Mr. Atherton is also present. This is a case in which the undisputed facts establish under the applicable reasonable person standard that plaintiffs knew facts essential to their claims more than 3 years before suit was filed. Mr. Siegel had touched on it. The lawsuit was filed in this case on February 8th of 2013. So to go back 3 years from that, as long as there were facts essential prior to February of 2010, the case is time barred. The facts in this case are significant, they're substantial, and they're undisputed in these areas. There's no dispute on any of these facts. The transactions involved here were completed in 2006 into 2007. It was a conservation easement transaction and followed by some of the tax credit sales. Mr. Atherton left the Snell & Wilmer firm in the spring of 2007. So that's the operative time when all of the work had been completed. As set forth in our brief, within a year, all of this began to unravel. Undisputed facts established in fall of 2007, Mr. Buchanan received a subpoena from the Division of the Real Estate, Colorado Division of Real Estate. Undisputed fact, that's a documentary evidence that's so testified by Mr. Plackey, by Mr. Buchanan. In November of 2007, Mr. Buchanan hired the Rothgerber Law Firm, undisputed fact. According to the engagement agreement with the Rothgerber firm, the purpose of the engagement was in connection with potential tax consequences related to conservation easement. It's a document that's undisputed, undisputed fact, November of 2007.
Mr. Palmieri, pardon me for interrupting you, but I want to let you in on a concern I have. I understand the litany of facts you're going to go through. You raised them very clearly and directly, both below and in front of us. My concern is that there are also countervailing facts in the record that at least at this point, perhaps not later in front of a jury, but at this point, my concern is, do these facts establish a genuine issue of material fact on whether Mr. Buchanan and the plaintiffs knew or should have known? And let me give you just one example, and then please proceed to answer my question. But the example is, and Mr. Siegel brought this up, Mr. Buchanan gets a lawyer from the Rothgerber firm, and this Rothgerber attorney establishes a relationship with Mr. Buchanan, and he tells Mr. Buchanan some things, including when he arranges for the memorandum of understanding with the Department of Revenue, and at the end of that, a reasonable person might say, well, Buchanan thinks he's off the hook for this and it's not a problem. And then he also, when Snell and Wilmer come aboard to Rothgerber, he says, now you can get your own lawyers if you think you've got claims, but I don't think you've got a conflict. So at this point, my concern is, has Mr. Buchanan, through advice of counsel, been given countervailing information to the facts that you're listing?
Happy to address that, Judge Bernard.
Thank
First,
you.
Let me address the Memorandum of Understanding. The Memorandum of Understanding was in February of 2008. Attorney's fees were incurred to ameliorate issues having to do with conservation easement. There is no countervailing argument to that fact. The standard under Colorado law is that if you are aware of facts that may be caused by the wrongdoing of another, even if you're not familiar with all of the information, all of the facts, all of the legal theories, you have the obligation under the Olson case and the other cases to exercise your due diligence at that point in time. So let's focus. Go ahead.
Pardon me again for interrupting. No. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be rude.
Don't apologize.
But again, he's dealing with his own counsel, and his counsel is saying we're fixing this. And so the first time, as far as I can tell from going through the record, the first time that anybody characterizes these fees as damages is when Sherman and Howard files this lawsuit.
Let's assume, Judge Bernard, that they completely fixed it. The memorandum of understanding did not do that, by the way. What it did was left things open. Let's assume that there's a full and final release at that point in time. He still had a claim. He had a claim at that point in time. He had information, the alleged allegation, the alleged fraud and allegation here is, one example, the Colorado General Assembly and the legislature encourages these types of conservation easements. He knew that that was false by the time he dealt with the memorandum of understanding. He knew that that representation was false. He incurred damages in the form of the attorney's fees to ameliorate that wrongful conduct. That cause of action accrued at that point in time. So even if it was completely fixed, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have a cause of action. To the contrary, in fact, the clock started at that point in time. Let's carry it then through to the summer. So now we know that it didn't fix everything because he continues to be represented by the Rothberger firm. And what he is then told is, with Mr. Plackey, that the law firm, the Rothberger firm, has been engaged to represent Snell and Wilmer in defense of a conservation easement case against or involving Mr. Atherton.
Different case, though.
But different lawsuit, you bet. But so now it's he's being informed, my law firm, speaking for Mr. Plackey, is representing Snell and Wilmer in connection with another lawsuit, alleged malpractice against Mr. Atherton. And in fact, the allegations in the case, as much as we say it's a different lawsuit, and it's in the record, it's established that there were fraud and CCPA claims in that bluff lawsuit as well. So by the summer of 2008, some of the plaintiffs out in the world had retained counsel and had filed a lawsuit against Mr. Atherton and the law firm alleging fraud and CCPA. Mr. Buchanan was made aware of that by the Rothberger law firm. Now, Mr. Plackey says, I don't know, Mr. Buchanan, whether you have a claim or not. That's the allegation. The deposition, this is at CF 519, the pages 126, 127, 128 of the Plackey deposition are addressed there. And what he says is, and his notes so reflect, his contemporaneous notes at the time say, if you are interested in pursuing a claim like that, he needed to get his counsel, new counsel, immediately. I didn't know if he had a claim, but I told him that if he was interested in pursuing a claim, he needed to get counsel immediately. So what we have here is the Plackey conversation there, just like the memorandum of understanding, doesn't change or differentiate from the reasonable person standard.
And if I may, again, and I'm just trying to test this for my purposes. All right, but if you have an attorney who says, I don't know if you have a claim, how does the client know if he or she has damages?
He needs to go seek a different lawyer. The damages that he incurred, he paid the lawyer fees. That is undisputed. Let's go back to the MOU. He incurred attorney's fees to ameliorate the damage in the memorandum of understanding. That is an undisputed fact. And regardless of what Mr. Plackey says about it after, and whether the plaintiffs actually pursue those attorney's fees as damages, which during the course of the hearing said, well, we're not going to pursue those. They were incurred. Those attorney's fees continued then throughout just the MOU, but throughout the summer. And when you look at all of the other facts, and I won't go through the litany, but just to highlight a couple, even in Mr. Buchanan's own words, when he was interviewed by the Colorado Division of Real Estate, the buzzers went off in his head. So what we have here, Your Honor, is not just a situation where, hey, we dealt with the memorandum of understanding, we have a lawyer doesn't know if you have a case, I didn't think I had anything else. Why would I worry about anything else? Even if we had that in isolation, I submit there was a claim with that MOU. But when you add on to that, you have the Colorado Department of Revenue, you have the Colorado Division of Real Estate, you have the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel. When you're actually being interviewed, Mr. Buchanan was interviewed by the Office of Attorney Regulation with respect to ethics violations against his lawyer in that transaction, actually interviewed in that context with counsel, paying counsel for that. In every forum, the Department of Revenue, the Division of Real Estate, the appraisers are suspended. The actual appraisers who did the appraisal on his property are suspended. He's made aware of that in 2008. His counsel, his attorney is now subject to ethics violations. He's interviewed by the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel. A lawsuit has been filed against him, his former lawyer. This case and the undisputed facts that we have establish under a reasonable person, an objective standard under Olson, establish undisputed facts that whether there are any countervailing facts or not, which we dispute, the undisputed facts that he had established that the clock began and that the cause of action accrued at that point in time. I'd like to briefly address Mr. Siegel's argument on the inquiry notice. This is an argument or an issue that he had raised with Judge Frick. In the record, in the transcript of the hearing, at pages 20 to 21, Judge Frick and I had a colloquy in which she addressed the inquiry notice. At line 3, she said, "Now the plaintiffs said that what you're arguing there is inquiry notice." And then I go on at the bottom of page 20 to the top of page 21, citing the Morris versus Gear case, which talks about as long as you have facts that are essential to your claims, the cause of action accrues. And in fact, then I go on and say, we really talk about an objective standard here to be applied, and we talk about the Olson case. So throughout, the situation here isn't just the inquiry. What it does speak to, though, and there are any number of cases that have addressed it, in the court's order, she cites the Chittister case, for example, on a fraud claim, that a fraud claim accrues when the defrauded person has knowledge of facts which, in the exercise of proper prudence and diligence, would enable him to discover the fraud perpetrated against him. Chittister case, that's at CF 690. That's a quote from Judge Frick's order. She applied the proper standard there under the undisputed facts of this case, the litany in every forum. The information here is overwhelming. The statute of limitations isn't triggered in a situation like this, where you have counsel, attorney's fees incurred, issues with the Colorado Department of Revenue, issues with the Colorado Division of Real Estate, issues with the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel, and another lawsuit alleging fraud and CCPA. If you don't have, if that doesn't cause the cause of action for the statute of limitations to accrue, it's hard to conceive of more compelling facts.
Has he lost anything with regard to any of these transactions? In other words, he has incurred attorney fees and he has been addressed by other entities or agencies. But with respect to these particular transactions that he engaged in with Mr. Atherton, had he suffered any damages with regard to those?
Judge Marquez, I submit that yes, he had, in the form of the attorney's fees. But even beyond that, and again, the attorney's fees were incurred by the Rothgerber firm in connection with the MOU, and then continuing throughout that year, approximately $27,000 or more. But the MOU is significant in and of itself because it changed the deal. What happened with the MOU was the Colorado Department of Revenue and Mr. Buchanan entered an agreement to say that they reserved the right to attack the value as appraised, but they agreed that he could solve that problem by conveying additional real estate. But it allowed him to maintain the tax credit sales, so that protected him from the tax credit. So he changed his position there. His position was changed as a result of the MOU. I think that's a form of damages.
Right, but it's part of the compromise, is it not?
Well, sure. But there's always a quid pro quo in that. So the fact is, he incurred the damages in the form of the attorney's fees. He knew that he was running the risk of losing that. That the way that this was going to be funded, he had to have those tax credits. He had to have the ability to fund that. And that was at risk with the MOU. So he incurred that damage. He was aware that some of the misrepresentations, alleged misrepresentations had occurred. The facts that the General Assembly doesn't have a problem with that. All of that had come about by 2008. I'd be happy to address any of the questions that the court has. My co-defense counsel being kind enough to coordinate our argument on this. I don't know if she has anything further. At this point, Your Honor, we ask on behalf of all defendants that the court affirm the entry of summary judgment, the entry of judgment on behalf of the defendants in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Palmieri. And that actually consumes all the time for appellees. Mr. Siegel, you have some time left.
Not much. 18
not much.
Seconds.
I see.
Mr. Palmieri, I believe, did not correctly recite some of the evidence in the record. The buzzer statement had nothing to do with this transaction. It was the BDR2 transaction. The interview with regulatory counsel had nothing to do with this transaction. It was the BDR2 transaction. The record shows we did not know issues pertaining to problems with the appraisers regarding this transaction. I think that concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Thank you both for your excellent arguments. Those will be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision. In that regard, the matter stands submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.